Hello. I think we're ready to start our third and last panel. So we will resume our program of activities with our third and last panel entitled, It's All on the Web, So Why Bother? Let me introduce Ellen Aitken, Dean of the Faculty of Religious Studies, who will be the moderator of this panel.
Thank you, and welcome to all of you to this panel, which I think presents a really urgently pressing question on the interface of special collections and digitization in various ways. What we'll do in terms of a protocol for this session is that we have four panelists, and I'll introduce them all. We'll hear from them in turn, then I'll allow some time for them to respond to each other, and I've instructed them to sort of think about how they're responding to each other as they listen to one another, and then we'll leave time at the end for questions and comments from the floor. As you make comments from the floor, please go to one of the microphones. This is all being recorded, and that will help with that. So I'll introduce our four panelists, and this is not the order of speaking, but just simply order of identification. Here in the blue on my right is Fiona Black. Fiona Black is Associate Professor in the School of Information Management at Dalhousie. And her principal research relates to how information studies perspectives can aid historical scholarship. And she is the co-editor of a bilingual project for A History of the Book in Canada. Next, Julie Cumming, who is here from McGill, where she is Associate Dean of Research and Administration and teaches in the Department of Music Research in the Schulich School of Music. Her major area of expertise is late medieval and Renaissance polyphony, and she currently is working on a project on music printing in the Renaissance and is the principal investigator of a digging into data challenge, Elvis. Electronic locator of vertical interval successions. Little did Elvis know, right? the data challenge grant. Then turning to my left, Leslie Howsam is the university professor in the Department of History at the University of Windsor. She is president since 2009 of the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing, known as SHARP, the major international society for book history. And I'm glad you've come. And then to her left, recently having joined McGill, Professor Stefan Sinclair is Associate Professor of Digital Humanities. Here and serves as vice president of both the Association for Computers and the Humanities and the Canadian Society for Digital Humanities. And his primary area of research is in the design, development, usage, and theorization of tools for the digital humanities. And I can attest to the very active work he's doing by the number of emails I get from him and his group every week. But thank you. Lindsay Eckert, who is to be the fifth panelist, is not able to be with us. She's ill and sends her deep regrets that she could not join today. So we'll turn first to Leslie Howsam for some remarks.
Thanks very much, Ellen, and I'd like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me. I have thoroughly enjoyed this day and learned a great deal, and it's just a huge pleasure to be at McGill. I'm going to talk about this from the perspective of a history professor who teaches the history of the book to undergraduates. In a sense, I'm also speaking from the perspective of SHARP insofar as the Society for the History of Authorship, Reading, and Publishing is vitally interested in the next generation of book historians who are our current undergraduates. So the teaching and learning of the history of the book seems to be vitally important. So I'll start by thinking about how we've all bemoaned the fact that in the last 10 or 15 years at least, the study of bibliography has no longer been routinely taught in English departments, even to graduate students, the way it used to be. And I certainly bemoan that too, although as a student of history, I never really would have had that opportunity anyway, and nor would my students. But what I want to think about also is that during that same 10 or 15 years, a lot of people have started teaching the history of the book, not just to graduate students, but also to undergrads. And not just in English, but in history, and sometimes in fields like communication and cultural studies as well. So there's a sense in which we're not doing what we used to do. We used to, or my predecessors used to, address the cream of the crop, the cream of the undergraduate crop who had gone on to do at least MAs or PhDs in English. They already knew a lot about old books. They knew the difference between a quarto and a folio of Shakespeare, for example, from a literary point of view, and they were all ready to get their hands on one and learn about it from a bibliographical point of view. So it's really different now. We're talking to kids who don't sometimes have not experienced a great deal in terms of physical books, even except perhaps going to the library with their families or their occasional foray to the university library. And in terms of literature, sometimes, especially if they're not an English student or a student of French or German or whatever literature, it's just what they like to read. They don't necessarily have very much familiarity with the literary canon, and yet they turn up in our classes. So in one sense, that's utterly horrifying. But what I wanted to do is think about it in a bit more positive way, because in another way, it's kind of liberating. I think the learners who, they're tabula rasa in a way, these digital natives who are coming into education nowadays. In a way that aspiring MA or PhD in English a few years ago wasn't. That person had already learned quite a lot, had already learned some things about how to think about books, and perhaps had unlearned some things that might have allowed him or her to think about books in a really different way. So people, I've observed a lot of reactions and had some observations in the past few years of what is really possible in teaching and learning the history of the book. The classic example of this kind of reaction is something I wrote about because it was such a great line. I had a student a few years ago who wrote on her take-home exam, "The book is a shapeshifter." Mm-hmm. And to me, that actually captured a great deal of what we want to teach people about how books change, how you can't be certain that one edition is the same as the other without looking at it, all the things that that we struggle to teach our student, and yet she had translated it into modern-day vernacular. So I thought that's a wonderful way of thinking about what can happen when people are introduced to books at this very early stage. I'd lectured her class about the history of writing, about manuscript culture, the introduction of the codex to replace the scroll, trying to make the moment of Gutenberg important but not the foundation of everything. I had given the class various things to read, of course, by scholars studying authorship and publishing and reading. And, of course, I had also taken them to the library. And it seems to me that a vital part of any course of study on the history of the book is a visit or a series of visits or an opportunity to do projects in the rare book library of one's university. But another vital part is the experience of books that are either not in one's own campus's special collections or it for whatever other reason needs to be accessed by the internet. And I should turn a little bit. I'm losing track of my notes here. I should mention at this point that in spite of their vaunted digital literacy, students mostly don't know that rare books and old books are available on the internet. They certainly need guidance as to how to use them. I have a colleague who studied at Oxford, and when she first came to Windsor, you know, recognized that her students with a relatively limited university library were going to have a very different experience than she had it with access to the Bodleian. But now that she has access to Echo and Ebo, her students, my students, do have access, in a sense, to the Bodleian, but only in a sense. We have to help students to understand the difference between something like Google Books, the mass digitization, and the very careful kinds of projects that those of you who are librarians are very familiar with about carefully and properly making books available in digital form. The reason I think this is so important is because I have some really ambitious ideas about teaching and learning the history of the book. I think it's something that should be a basic part of a humanities education. It's in a way, in terms of history, which is what I'm most familiar with, it's a way of introducing a kind of global history of knowledge and a global history of culture. And a way of structuring the periodization of all of that, which doesn't necessarily privilege the European, because you can start with First Nations writing and reading and the way that that works, or you can start with ancient cultures and writing and reading and move from those into other ways of writing and reading. So you're not starting with the European in the way that we used to have to. And so you can frame cultural history as a kind of history of communication and include the oral and manuscript cultures in the frame. And for literature, I think it's a way of introducing students to literature when they have not been well grounded in high school, and that is often the fact. Book history allows students to relate what they know about adaptation, perhaps from film to television and so forth, to what they can learn about the way in which books are created collaboratively. Eventually, of course, they are going to have to read the book, but this way of introducing them, it may be a different way of introducing people who haven't already been introduced to a canon in the early part of their education. So I think in this context, both actual visits to the Rare Book Library and the opportunity to see digital representations, both are important. Starting with in-person visits, I should say that my own students are doing that this very week at Windsor. As I'm here in Montreal, they are having their opportunity to visit Rare Books and Special Collections, and I've seen that Dorothea effect, as Gillian called it, when students just get tremendously excited about seeing an old book that has been introduced to them. So that opportunity to handle and read old books, I think, will enhance their understanding of the lectures and everything else that they get on the history of the book. And by seeing the materials themselves, they'll have a much deeper understanding of the nature, especially of early modern printing. When there's no Rare Books Library where it doesn't contain a copy of the book in question, I think that's where we have to learn, and we need to work harder on this as teachers, to think about how we really use the digital images of Rare Books to make education happen with our students, help them to learn. I think the challenge of all this is going to be the interplay between the inexperience of undergraduates and the specialized knowledge of special collections scholars. Perhaps I should say the specialized knowledge of scholars, period. Thinking about someone like Raymond Klebanski, it's hard to imagine the distance between him and the 20-year-old that I'm imagining who needs to be introduced to practically everything about the humanities. But the gap, I think, between his polymath knowledge and their the experience of the digital native is what we need to figure out a way to deal with. My colleagues will be talking about the specifics of making Rare Books available on the internet, but my point is just that the 20-year-old is most likely to first encounter old books that way, and I think we need to take that fact into consideration. Thank you.
Turn now to Julie Cunning.
It's going to take a second.
Second. Yeah.
Okay. There we go. We should be fine here. So I'm just going to get to the top of this. Okay. So I'm going to start with the title of this panel discussion. It is all on the web, so why bother? Special collections in the digital age. Why bother with what? The implied question is, why bother with maintaining, expanding, supporting, and curating special collections? This question stems from what is becoming a widely held belief. Now that almost everything is on the internet, librarians and library collections are no longer necessary. But the exact opposite is true. Special collections and librarians to curate them are more important than ever before. And of course, I think I'm preaching to the converted here, but I still think this needs saying. So to state the obvious, online digital collections with a historical focus derive from special collections of physical materials, printed books, manuscripts, sheet music, paintings, drawings, maps, costumes, and so on. Without libraries and special collections, there would be no historical digital collections. Libraries and special collections are much more than collections of items to be photographed, however. It is the trained professionals, librarians and scholars, who curate those collections that make the difference. First of all, these professionals choose what to collect. They assess importance and value, and they commit to maintaining cultural heritage. The great digital repositories, such as the Gallica at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris or Munich's Bayerische Staatsbibliothek collection, are the product of careful choice and curation by libraries and scholars over centuries. And to state the obvious once more, the past is not over. It never will be over. Non-digital historical documents and artworks still exist and will continue to exist. We need to continue to collect physical materials in libraries and special collections with highly trained specialist librarians to curate them. And of course, a librarian's work does not end with the acquisition of the item. Librarians categorize and catalog the items and store them so that they can be easily retrieved. They discover and record what the items are, where they came from, when they were created, and their path from creation to the special collection. To use digital speak, they create metadata, which is crucial to assessing the authority of where it came from. And in order to be useful for serious research, we have to know about where it came from. And this is not just an academic issue. Important people make decisions every day on the basis of information stored in libraries and special collections. Those decisions will only be as good as the information on which they are based. And one more point about physical special collections. Some kinds of research still require examination of the actual physical item. It is very hard to alter a physical document without leaving a trace. It is ridiculously easy to do that for digital documents. That's why they require original receipts for our expense reports. So for the ultimate measure of authenticity, we need to be able to go back to the physical original. And for all other kinds of studies, such as the gathering structure of a book or manuscript, the texture of the paint, and so forth, we need the originals. We therefore have to keep maintaining these collections and preserving these items. This is not to say, however, that I'm against digital collections. I am, in fact, a huge fan, as long as the digital collection is organized and curated as well as the physical collection. Digitization of a physical special collection, when done right, can make it possible not only to learn more and learn faster, but also to learn things that were hidden before. Digital photos with ultraviolet light, for example, can reveal things on a page that are invisible to the naked eye. And they can help us sort out bleed through on two sides of a page or palimpsests. Optical character recognition, being able to actually know what letters and words are on the page, has made it possible to search within individual documents and across millions of documents, something that is revolutionizing research in many domains, and that's Stefan's expertise. Digitization also makes it possible to bring into one digital space information that is found in different places in the physical world. This could be two parts of a single manuscript now found in different libraries, or it could be complete texts of two different sources of the same work, or it could be an index and a document. So now I'm going to tell a story about how a Chant manuscript in the Canadian Special Collection ended up as the center of a digital project created by colleagues and students at McGill. So we'll start with our special collection. And so this is the University Archives of St. Mary's University, Halifax, in Nova Scotia, which is housed in the Patrick Power Library. And I'm going to scroll down on that a little bit. Here we go. So there it is. And in that collection, there is a manuscript called the Saltzin Antiphonal. You can see it over on the side. Now I'll take you to that. So here's the page on the library website. Find my mouse again. There we go. Here's the page on the library website for the Saltzin Antiphonal. Oops, didn't work. Here goes. Okay, so this is the page for this manuscript. You can see some images from it on the side. And you can see that this page actually provides metadata on the manuscript. It tells you the history of the manuscript. If I scroll down, it would tell you where it came from, how it got to Halifax, and you can see it says something where it came from and so forth. The person who... there was a person named Judy Dietz who was doing a master's degree at St. Mary's University who wrote her master's thesis on this manuscript. And in the and I want to just show you, there's a little article about this manuscript that actually gives you a sense of the size of it. You can actually see how big it is and how beautiful it is. And this is an article partly about her work on the manuscript and about a conference that was held that in which this was a central item. Now, in the process of working on her master's thesis, she did an index of the manuscript for the Cantus database. And the Cantus database, here we go, just a second. There we go. So the Cantus database is an online database for Latin ecclesiastical chant. It includes online indices for hundreds of chant manuscripts. And it was actually one of the very first online tools for musicology. It was started at Catholic University by a musicologist named Ruth Steiner back in the late 70s. And Achiro Fujinaga, my colleague here, actually went on a pilgrimage to meet her. And at that time, all she had was index cards. and now it's this great online resource. So you can read again. This has, in fact, more metadata on the manuscript. The kind of metadata that chant scholars want. It tells you what part of the liturgical year is included in the manuscript and other aspects of the actual details. It also includes an index of the manuscript, and that looks like this. I think here it comes. I'll try that one again. Okay, so this is pretty arcane stuff. You really have to understand there's a lot of abbreviations. You have to know that H stands for hymn and V stands for Vespers and so forth. But with the use of this index, you can actually do all kinds of neat things. At the same time that Judy Dietz was working on this manuscript and creating this index for the Cantus database, my colleague Ichiro Fujinaga in music technology at McGill was working on developing optical music recognition for chant. And he was started out with a printed chant book, the Liber Usualis. And this site allows you to search for musical strings of notes in a book of chant. So he actually taught the computer to understand the pneumatic notation of the chant, a printed chant book. And then once he'd finished the Liber project, he says, I want to try this with a manuscript now. And I want a nice, big, clear manuscript that will be easy. And that was just weeks after I had just talked to Jennifer Bain, who was at Dalhousie, a former student at McGill, who actually had worked with Judy Dietz on creating this index and had just had this conference about the manuscript. And Jennifer Bain, there was actually a little local TV clip about it, and she sent me the link to that clip. And so Jiro said, I need a manuscript. And I said, the Saltzin Antiphoner. And so they're actually just about finished doing optical music recognition on the Saltzin Antiphoner. But while they were working on teaching the computer to read the notation, some of the students also came along and said, let's put together the images of the manuscript with the Cantus database. And it's a kind of mashup of these two sources. And this is what the site looks like. This is slightly awkward because I have to turn around, but I will see what I can do here. So you can scroll down, and you notice that each time I get to another page, new things appear on the right. Well, what's on the right here is, in fact, the chants that appear on each page. So with each new page, it tells me, now here's this beautiful page. And in fact, you can see the nuns on the bottom left. Those are the nuns of the monastery from where this manuscript was created. And you can also blow this up, make it bigger. So I'm going to move this. And now we can get down and see the nuns. Sorry. And you can actually see their names at the bottom. So it's a great way of getting around the manuscript, seeing it very small, very large, and you can search it. So on the top left, you can actually search for anything that's in the Cantus database. So you can search for all the antiphons with the text Angelus in them and mode one or whatever. So it's an incredibly useful tool. So these two tools, both the Liber and the Cantus database, actually make it possible for novices to get involved in Gregorian chant in a way that they never could before. And one of my colleagues at Columbia, Susan Boynton, who's a chant scholar, she says with these tools, she now has undergraduates doing real research on chant. When it would have taken months to train them before, they're now able to use these digital tools. And so they're connecting with the metadata. So, to conclude, thanks to digital photographs, metadata from the Cantus database, the internet, and the ongoing collaboration between scholars and librarians and computer people, we can do things that we could never do before. But remember, it all began with a physical manuscript lovingly curated in a Canadian special collection. Thank you. Here we go.
Thank you, Julie. Let's do a quick changeover.
There you go. Oops.
Computers. And then hear from Fiona.
You probably have it perfect. The dirty little secret is that digital humanities is being the technical person in the room.
Yes.
And that's the next slide.
And I just use this?
Yeah.
Right. Thank you so much, Stefan.
Hello, everyone. It's a real privilege to be here. And there is definitely, it seems, a Halifax and Montreal connection here today. We've just heard from Julia with an example from a special collection at St. Mary's University in Halifax. And I am at Dalhousie University. And for those of you who have any history in your background, you will perhaps realize that James McGill and George Ramsay, Lord Dalhousie, were both Scots. And it happens that I am too, but that is nothing to do. I'm not attaching my name to both of their names as well. I'm an educator of librarians. So when I was introduced as a professor of information management, which is very true. And I was part of the group that changed the name of our school for all sorts of strategic reasons, from the School of Library and Information Studies to the School of Information Management. And we offer more than one degree now. But I'm taking a tack in my few comments here about the education side of librarians, and I'm going to interweave it with a few stories. There is what SHRC has recently termed, SHRC being the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, which funds some of my work as well as funding some of the rest of us on this panel. There is what Shirk has recently termed a research and discovery ecosystem that I believe requires a careful balancing of preservation, access, analysis, and interpretation. I've spent what must be thousands of hours in special collections and archives, quiet hours, absorbed hours, in the contemplative atmosphere of institutions ranging from the Prairie History Room in Regina Public Library, Saskatchewan, to the Bodleian at Oxford. The value of discovery, digitally enabled and otherwise, lies in what we do with the discovered data and information. The materials I read and subsequently have analysed in most of the special collections I've researched in have yet to be digitised, though many remain available on microfilm. Remember that? And when Julia was speaking and saying how wonderful digitisation is for pulling together disparate parts of collections and related collections into one accessible tool. Actually, the early microfilmers from last century did just that with 18th century Canadian newspapers, which I read for many early Canadian cities before there was Canada, on snowy nights in an otherwise locked library in Regina, Saskatchewan. So yay for the microfilmers too. Microfilm was a crucially important precursor to digitization. In considering the materials I use, the research I conduct, and the realm of digitization, I'd like to concentrate on the people whose deep knowledge of their collections, scholarly service ethic, and, budgets permitting, willingness to experiment through the years with emerging technologies have enabled the discovery and generation of new understandings in our various fields. When my student Robin Parker and I were doing a small project in digital humanities, I used geographic information systems technology to try to tease out patterns of book movements and book sellers and merchants across the North Atlantic, which is why we have an anchoring map behind me just now. When we were starting our work, we were using old maps before there were any generally available collections of digitized historical maps. And the work that we did together involved an enormous amount of very careful georeferencing, autocorrelation to the face of the Earth. This was a long time before Google Earth and Google Maps facilitated overlaying historical maps for historical inquiry, which they do now. That doesn't mean it's easy. There are still all sorts of levels and layers to work with. But I suppose what the point I'm wanting to make is that many scholars and librarians, I was aided by many librarians in many special collections who held various maps that we needed, and they would take digital photographs of the maps, which we would then georeference. So there has been a lot of work leading up to where we are now, of course. Bear with me one second while I open again my digital tool here. So my first people element is service in the digital realm. As I mentioned, I'm an educator of librarians, and I practiced librarianship for several happy years in Saskatchewan. I hire gifted graduate research assistants to aid in my continuing explorations of the applications of GIS for the study of 19th century book history. I learn and teach with wonderful students, and I'm always delighted when they exceed my expectations. I wonder which of them will turn out to be like Special Collections librarian Ken Aitken, whose knowledge of prairie history was unsurpassed and whose generosity of spirit led him to start a blog several years ago when blogging was very new, to address patron queries and larger issues in history and genealogy when amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease prevented him from being present in person in his special collection. Being able to reference digital examples permitted Ken's fine mind to inform others until just a few weeks before his death. I hope my students will emulate Ken, and that none of them will be like the wretched, remarkably senior staff member at my beloved National Library of Scotland, Manuscripts and Special Collections Division, who, on a daft and irreversible whim a number of years ago, decided that he, never mind his patrons and clients and users, would prefer to use the Scottish Book Trade Index, a wonderful resource, an index of booksellers through several centuries in Scotland, he would prefer to use it in Word format rather than as a database. He pulled all of the records, which was perfectly reasonable, into Word, but then he deleted the only copy of the database. His shocking unprofessionalism have to this day not been addressed for a number of budgetary and strategic reasons, although several of us who regularly do work at the National Library of Scotland regularly make the request that this wonderful resource be put back into database form. Thus, regardless of the format of the materials provided in special collections, it is the professional knowledge and the service ethic of librarians and archivists which I like to champion. I'd like to unpack the concept of knowledge in relation to special collections briefly. In the most recent annual report from SHRC, mention is made of the generation of knowledge about people, institutions, and systems, and what makes them tick, with a particular emphasis on the funding agency's desire to support people with curiosity and determination who ask unexpected questions and who produce invaluable answers. Digitized special collections enable outreach to both younger and different learners and researchers so that when these individuals eventually see the original item, they have these Dorothea moments that we've heard about today, because they are both familiar with some aspects of the object and gloriously stunned by the difference of the reality. I remember such feelings when following a long-distance exploration through digital and other means of the special book collections housed in the Hudson's Bay Company archives, one of the archive at the top of the picture behind me, within the Provincial Archives of Manitoba. I arrived one weekend to explore the books for myself, books which had been ordered with careful deliberation in 1 year by fur traders, and which had been sent from London on the little supply vessel sailing into Hudson's Bay the next year. No Amazon.com in those days. I had imagined the care with which such precious cargoes would be treated when they were finally delivered to those far-flung readers. What did I discover in that mind-expanding Manitoban special collection? I certainly discovered that great care had been taken. I discovered the beautiful books by the explorer and surveyor Peter Fiddler, who bound his own books with the skins of the does that he would shoot for his family. He married a native woman and had 13 children, and certainly was kept busy feeding them. He then brushed the edges of the pages of the books that he bound with the pollen from prairie crocuses. And when you go into the cold, cold vault in the Hudson's Bay Company archives and look along the shelves, that yellow pollen gleams more gold than the gold leaf on some of the books in the Bodleian. It is a testament to Peter Fiddler's love for his books in the later 18th century. But what else did I discover? Some of the evidence I saw was that some of those books had been used to swat monstrous northern mosquitoes and had been left behind in some of the fur trading outposts where birds had roosted on them, leaving behind tufts of feathers and less mentionable evidence. Having lived in the prairies, I empathized with the fur traders in their swatting of mosquitoes and hoped that when some of those volumes are eventually digitized, that the scanning staff will not blow off the remnants of those insects that tell a story of book use all of their own. In thinking of those long-dead mosquitoes, however, I also think of our entrepreneurial students in the Master of Library and Information Studies program at Dalhousie, a few of whom last year launched a project to investigate the applications of yet another emerging digital technology, that of three-dimensional or 3D printing, specifically for use in academic libraries, including special collections. Perhaps such 3D technologies, which in future will be available in our homes, if we believe the marketing hype, as conveniently as digital texts are now available to us on our home computer screens, will help ensure that accessibility can include not only the words, but the more material evidence we long for as scholars, so that we can hold the books. They will be made of various types of polymer, but so that we can hold them and see all of the levels of evidence. So another element necessary for special collections staff is a spirit of entrepreneurialism as well as a service ethic. Our students, by the way, won a recent business case competition in Atlantic Canada, to the utter surprise of all of the MBA students who were also in the competition, based on their proposal regarding 3D printing. Their work would not have been feasible without collaboration and partnerships, and this is my final theme. Here we are in extremely well-known territory, as the world of librarianship has long demonstrated the value of collaboration, sharing, consortial development, and more. In scholarly terms, new forms of collaboration are feasible with digitized materials, as far-flung scholarly collaborators may view in real time the same manuscripts, printed items, or objects, and enrich their understandings through real-time, though distance, conversation. My principal collaborators on my current SHRC-funded project are respectively in Scotland and New Zealand. Digital materials and digital means of communication are essential for our work, but each in our own way, we visit the original materials in our home countries. Given these brief comments, it seems that education for special collections librarians should include courses which generate a fearlessness with technology, which foster entrepreneurship and abilities to seek essential funding, often from the private sector, which instill the continuing need for scholarship by librarians in order to enable an invaluable level of service and outreach to other scholars. It is individuals with all of these skills who are developing a 21st century special collection. Any number might be given as examples, and I shall choose just one that was recently reviewed in Sharp News, which is the quarterly newsletter of the society of which Leslie is the president. The review was of a resource called 18th Connect, which was developed by a team in the US, England, Scotland, and Ireland, and which allows scholars to locate, annotate, and curate 18th century primary texts in innovative ways, as well as providing social media functions that enable new modalities for discussion, exchange, and even pedagogy. And that last sentence was a quote from the review. In addition, this web-based resource aims to be, like its equivalent 19th century project on which it was modeled, a clearinghouse for digital peer-reviewed projects that are using the online collections. This is just one example of the convergence long spoken of in relation to archives, special collections, and libraries, and now publishing, which is evidenced in ways we are perhaps astonishingly and certainly usefully already taking for granted. Educating special collections librarians also requires unpacking what it means to be a member of the so-called born digital generation, to which my colleagues have already alluded. Students of this generation have become themselves the focus of study, including within the domain of library and information science. To be born digital does not, perhaps regrettably, mean that one understands the digital world, simply that one is comfortable within it. Students in MLIS programs still require an education that enables them to understand the policies, ethics, applications, and implications of the digital world. To take one example, what does it mean to use crowdsourcing as a means of checking the accuracy of digitized materials? This is an extremely well-known technique used in the private sector, the public sector, and now in scholarly circles. And it's proven invaluable for doing such things as checking the accuracy of OCR-related texts, generated texts. For complex scholarly projects, how should the individuals in these so-called crowds be acknowledged, however? Where does the intellectual property for new editions reside? These are variations of well-established issues, and the debates do not go away. I'd like to conclude with reference to a recent study in the UK that provides a potentially terrific model for Canada, and its disk map, and the logo for it is behind me now. The disk map project was designed to find a way to set strategies for assessing and prioritizing the digitization of special collections. Birrell, Dubrava, and their colleagues set out to determine how a large-scale digitization of UK special collections could serve the needs of higher education communities in the future. Between September 2008 and March 2009, in a recently published paper, the DISC team describe how they asked over 1,200 librarians, curators, and collections managers and end users, who were researchers, teachers, and subject-specific societies like SHARP, a range of questions about which physical and digital special collections they make use of and what criteria they feel must be considered when selecting materials for digitization. Answers were gathered through online questionnaires, phone interviews, and focus groups. 945 special collections were suggested for digitization, and they have now prioritized a shortlist from this. How wonderful it would be if perhaps our Library and Archives Canada or some other body in Canada could build on the new knowledge of the emerging generation of special collections librarians to perform such a study here, so that we can prioritize for the benefit of all of us what we will digitize, and so that it will not be for naught. Thank you very much.
So I make no claim to have intimate knowledge of the Klebanski collection or even some of the deeper information studies management knowledge, nor the lyricism and humor of Fiona and my fellow colleagues here. I have much more modest ambitions, which is to give you a sense of what a kid in a candy store, which is me with text data, what that looks like, some of the experiments, some of the things that we could do with tools, and of course, as Ellen was mentioning in the introduction, the design and development of tools for humanities scholars, which I wish I had another 10 minutes to unpack, because that's saying a lot, I think, what that can look like, how that design, how that functions. About 2 weeks ago, I'll telescope time a bit to make it sound like I started this earlier than when I should have. And, I went to the McGill Library site to see what I could gather as information from the Klebanski metadata, from the Klebanski collection. And there's actually a really great interface that that allows for querying. I couldn't quite rank. There's a beginner, intermediate, expert, ninja mode to the library system, and I couldn't figure out how to scrape all of the records out. I guess you can do it 3,000 at a time, but I wanted all of them. So I asked Jillian Tom to if perhaps she would be willing to share with me any metadata she has. And she was. And one of the first things that really struck me is that this spreadsheet had 85 columns of metadata. You know, maybe those of you in information studies are used to this, but I'm not. I'm used to, you know, at sometimes Gutenberg plain text files with just about no metadata. At best, maybe text encoding initiative files with some Dublin Core and a bit more. But this was an enormous amount of metadata associated with the records. Nearly 7,000 records in this spreadsheet. This is a lot. There's some talk of what big data means. And, you know, in sort of for astrophysics, that work with terabytes and petabytes of data, this isn't maybe big data. But people who work on what it means for a scholar to encounter, to experiment with thousands of texts, the 7,000 volumes represented here would take decades to read if you read nonstop every day. You can start to do things, interesting things, because there's information in digital form. I was especially interested in looking through these 85 columns, these fields. I was especially interested in a subset of these about the acquisition of the materials. And as you can see, it's pretty, you know, in statistical parlance, it's pretty sparse data. We don't actually have a lot of data on the date that certain volumes were acquired into the Klebanski collection. In humanistic terms, this is, you know, not sparse data. It's a shame. It's too bad. But we sort of do with what we can. So I was interested in focusing in on the acquisition information, and I looked through. Is Jillian here? I looked through the a presentation that Jillian was kind enough to share with me And maybe this was mentioned earlier today, I had to teach, but some really great aggregate views of what's in the collection, organized in various ways. This is one view, but there are several of them. I wanted to keep exploring that, and so what I did recently, I won't say how recently, but recently was to create a set of experiments to tinker with the data as much as I could, just as experiments. So this, by default, shows the total collections, the incoming volumes, here organized by decade. So the tick marks are a little bit misleading. It's not that it's in 1920, it's in the 1920s. But what's interesting is with the data, you can start to create interactive interfaces that allow you to do some different things. So if we get rid of the total number of volumes, I can start to zoom in on certain things and see different things. So if I just want to see the German collection, this gives a view of how it evolves over time. If I want to see the French and English and how they're sort of, they vary in lockstep, Latin has early success and then is much less common, for all kinds of reasons that we can create good hypotheses about. But again, I want to emphasize that this is me having first encounters with these metadata and trying to get a better understanding of what's there. A second kind of experiment was not just with the language data from the acquisition, but with all the metadata. This is an interface that we've developed called the Mandala browser that allows you to work with any XML content. And it allows me to do things like select the data field and create magnets for each of those values. So now what I have is those values sort of become magnets that pull towards each of those equally. And I get a sense of, these are in chronological order around the periphery, I get a sense of the size in each one. I may also want to add to that the acquisition bio period, which is essentially where the acquisition took place by country. So I can have Germany, England, Canada, and I can see that, again, because we're dealing chronologically, this venue is fantastic, but it's not a great teaching venue. Anyway, I can see that chronologically things, Germany is up here, England in the middle here, and then toward in the last part of the collection from Canada. I can also select these items. This is one of the principles that we care very much about, a panoramic view, overview of the data, but also allowing humanities scholars to go in and drill and to better read the content, so I can look at more specifically at the metadata for each of the rows. This is an example of doing a network, graphing the networks. So essentially what I've done here is taken the decades, and each of those have a set of links by keywords. So these keywords, it's worth mentioning, are a mess. In some cases, I have nice things like the state or state, comma, the. In other cases, I have keywords that are enormously long. But these can be treated atomically so that I may have in the field a set of keywords. I've split it up. Aristotle and the state may actually appear in the same keywords, but in this case, I'm treating them differently. And again, because this is interactive, I want to emphasize that a lot. This is a matter of exploring what's there, of better understanding, of multiplying the types of views and observations that I can have on the metadata with the metadata. A final view that I want to show is loading the keywords up into a web-based tool called Voyant that we've been developing. So essentially here, I put all the keywords into, by decade, there's one file per decade, and all the keywords were stuck there. I wanted to show this, part of what I care deeply about is making these tools accessible, user-friendly. And so what you just saw there, if you weren't listening to me exactly, was loading all of this up into the system. This is web-based, this is freely available.
I can click on certain words to start to see how they vary over time. These are organized chronologically, so it gives me a good sense of what's happening. I have a set of distinctive words. There's nothing fancy or semantic happening, but I can see that in the 2000s, biography is distinctly high frequency for that decade. For whatever sets of reasons, and this graph is wrong because it's based on that one year, but for whatever sets of reasons, biography is of much more interest later on in the collection. I can also compare different terms, literature and science, and then again get down to the level of reading what the keyword actually is. This is another type of visualization called the correspondence, that's doing correspondence analysis, which again allows me to look at the 2000s and see that biography, sorry, but reminds me of Prezi yes. when you're biography is naturally attracted. So each of the terms is plotted in a space, in a Cartesian space based on, so Ellen's not giving me the cane yanking, but the battery is. So let's see if we can get through a couple more things before it stops. No? Okay. So we'll not do that slide. How about that? And I wanted to end with this. I'll try and make, you're not supposed to see my notes. Which is suggesting that, you know, in the context of these little mini experiments of me spending an afternoon playing with the data, what's possible in allowing me to play, but in a very, I want to, you know, emphasize, I'm trying to rehabilitate play here as a mode of creating new forms of knowledge, of exploring things. And the relationship between special collections, that those metadata probably wouldn't exist in their form, in their rich form, if it weren't for the special collections, which is in a digitized form, which allows me to do the discovery, which then goes back and can enhance and modify and have an impact on my experience of the special collections. So really, it's, you know, I don't think collectively as a panel, I don't think there's any doubt that there's a value, you know, there's clearly a point to answer the rhetorical question of the panel. There's clearly a point to the digital. There's clearly a point to the special collections. I think the real challenge for us is in prioritizing, you know, in terms of budgets, what's important if it's a matter of maintaining special collections or versus acquisitions and that sort of thing. So, you know, that's an enormous question. Really, we're not necessarily tasked with answering it. But in some ways, I think there are compelling reasons to have the special collections to experiment with them in various ways. And there we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could the table mics be turned on, please? So thank you, Stefan, and all the panelists. We have about half an hour left in this session, and I'd like to turn first to the four panelists and let them respond to one another. I'm going to push my chair back just so I can see face signals to each other. Let's start.
You want to go? Well, I'm not sure that this is to a particular panelist. I think it's to all of us in a way. And I can't remember now who mentioned this. It might have been you, Leslie. Well, one of us, not me, talked about how the use of digital collections can enable original research by undergraduates. And I think that's an increasingly important area. And I wonder if my fellow panelists might address that.
That was something I was thinking about phrasing as a kind of a question or comment, because I do think it's a hugely important aspect, as I've already said. but I think also that the material needs to be packaged in a particular way for undergraduates. It's, maybe the analogy is with writing textbooks in an earlier generation, that we need to think about preparing material in such a way to anticipate the questions that would be asked. So I was thinking when Julie was talking about that wonderful musical project, and you said you needed to know the details of, you know, P for prosody or whatever it was to use the database. And I thought, you know, how do you, where do you go to learn to the details? Is that, would there be time in a teaching scenario to teach those details in order to have this person use the database? And then I thought about Stefan saying tools for digital, tools for humanities scholars, but it's also tools for humanities students, even for undergraduates that we're really looking towards.
And maybe if I come in on that, I mean, actually my point there was that in that original database, which was created at a time when they had limited number of characters per field and so forth, they had to use all these abbreviations. But in the new world, text is cheap, right? And you can spell out every abbreviation. And that's what we've done with the Saltzine Antiphonal project. And so actually we can make stuff that used to require really specialized knowledge much more easily accessible. And that's, I think, one of the great promises of this of the new age, is that we can make it possible to play. And I really like Stefan's point, is to play with data, to explore in ways, you know, what do you come up with if you just put three different things in a search engine? You know, what do you, and you might find out something really neat. But it does require thinking, I think, about the interface and the making it as transparent as possible in order to play freely in a way. Yeah.
Greg Crane, the editor-in-chief of the Perseus Project, was making that was the emphasis of his talk he gave in the fall. He was talking about having students do translation between Greek and Latin, something that undergraduate students, something that he would have done that early on. But because of the availability of tools and to be able to search for things to see examples, it was now something that could be incorporated at that level. But I, you know, more generally, I would say, and it's something that you alluded to. The business about digital natives being comfortable but not critical in understanding is really very true, and I would say that there's a much greater urgency for us in all of the humanities to incorporate to recognize the value of having students work with tools. I mean, I'm biased about this, of course, but we're in a digital society, we're in an information age, and we give them all sorts of skills for being critical thinkers, for expressing themselves, but very rarely in a digital context specifically. And so I think that's part of a larger picture as well.
If I could just jump in here, because I'm not as experienced in this as the panelists. I've done some work with this with undergraduates with ancient Greek and with the Perseus Project, but also in other dimensions. And it seemed to be important that there's that kind of balance between just letting them play and see what happens, the crazy stuff, which can, for some students, can become very frustrating.
Yes.
Or they get too much, they don't know what to do. And I think that's an important part of learning. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, is really setting up some experiments the way a chemistry professor might set up an experiment so you know you don't blow up the lab. You set up a pathway through a particular chant, for example, or towards a manuscript where you sort of know what's supposed to happen. And there is an experience of success.
Yeah, I wish she had been around 12 years ago when I started teaching this stuff to tell me that, because that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And that's essentially what I meant when I said packaging, is putting together an assignment in such a way that the result may not be perfectly anticipated, but it's you have some idea of what you think is going to happen.
Well, maybe I'll just wrap up this particular topic, if we might want to go on to another one, by saying that this is of particular interest to me because many universities, one of the hats I wear at Dalhousie is as Director of Academic Planning, and we're running an academic innovation initiative, and this is increasingly common
at research universities in Canada, whatever they call them, but they are trying to differentiate themselves. And one way, strategically, that special collections that are housed within university libraries or are affiliated with university libraries could access some of the strategic initiative funding that universities are now setting aside, even as they're having to cut funding elsewhere, they're trying to hold on to future planning, if you like, would be for special collections to work with their academic colleagues and say, we want to introduce a digital humanities program for undergrads, or we want to digitize these collections so that there can be more undergraduate research. So I think there are strategic partnerships here that in the university world that special collections can make that might be of real benefit to them in times of shrinking budgets.
I was really struck, and I pose this as a question to the four, by the way in which the people question wove in and out of your presentations, either in terms of students or curators or people who manage special collections. And so what kinds of people capacities about ethics, entrepreneurship, and it seems to me that that's a question that's not often talked about in relation to digitization project, and it's fascinating.
I mean, I'd like to talk to that for a minute. I mean, one of the things that people in the humanities who are so used to the single author model for scholarship and doing digital humanities works really requires, in almost every case, collaboration. And collaboration really of many kinds. So, you know, I work with the CHIRO, so there's a computer guy and a musicology guy. But in order to do the kind of work we're doing, we need a lot of students. We need a kind of lab model. And so we're also collaborating with our students. And for the students who's working on this kind of thing, it's fantastic. I mean, working in a lab, even a humanities lab, they're doing real research early on in their degrees. I mean, master's students, say, or some undergraduates. We have undergraduates working, too. And they're doing actually something that's going to have an effect in the real world, and they learn so much. I mean, we had a computer guy who does databases learn about chant as a result of working on this chant project. So, I mean, he never would have learned that. But then the chant expert learned from him about the computer thing. And so, I mean, I think this is it's a problem because we don't have the space. We don't have them in our buildings to have humanities labs. You know, we're the easy ones. We don't need labs. But it's also, I think, has a great deal of promise for a kind of sense of the relevance of the education. And so it's those collaborations that are kind of the lifeblood of this kind of thing and makes it sort of social and fun as well as intellectually stimulating.
Anyone else want to talk?
Other thoughts about people?
Well, I guess just that people tend to get left out of that formulation. It's all on the web anyway. The idea that digitization just happens somehow automatically is very prevalent in the sort of general idea of how this sort of thing works. And if we can return the people to it, then we're helping people to understand that there are judgments involved and choices involved.
You're here.
Other thoughts from among the panelists? Reactions as you listen to each other's talks?
I like people.
Right? Well, I mean,
you like people.
Maybe we could just come back to Stefan's last point, which is prioritization and basically how do we divide up the money? I mean, obviously we're not going to, very limited, smaller and smaller amounts of money for more and more projects. I mean, we're not going to answer that question, but maybe we could, I mean, do people have ideas about how we should be thinking about that? What would we have some values that we, things we won't give up or things that we want to happen no matter what?
And in that strange economy, of course, there's the benefit for the few, and the really clear and benefit that's difficult to deliver in other ways, versus maybe a smaller value, but for a larger population.
Yeah.
And that's difficult calculations to make, of course.
Let me turn then to all of you here in this audience and invite your questions of the panelists or your reflections on the thoughts that have been presented. And I suggest you come to the mic. Yep. Please.
The battery is gone.
It's not on. You could yield one of these. Here.
Good. Thank you. I've almost forgotten my question. I'm Bob Tittler, Emeritus Historian at Concordia and Adjunct Professor of Art History at Carleton. I'm wondering how much of this last exchange between Julia and Stefan particularly and reflecting back on what Gerald said in the last set of panels, the barbarians are at the gates of the universities. I think here at McGill we realize that much more than at some places. And it seems to me that what I'm hearing from this panel is the edge of a tremendous breakthrough in the possibilities of pedagogy. And I'm hoping that it can overcome what seems to me the impending and drastic decline in the kind of learning environment in which these small groups can function in a university department, university context. We're told to have fewer classes and very much larger classes. We're told that cutbacks must be in every way. If there's a question to this litany, I guess it must be this. To what extent are you beginning to feel that pressure already in the context of what you're talking about here, which is simply fascinating? And to what extent is it possible to do those things in a university and political climate of regression, which is what I see? I'm sorry to have to ask this question, but I think it's one that we need to contemplate. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks very much for raising that. One of the things that I've noticed at Dalhousie, and I know it's happening at some of the other U15, which is the terminology used for Canada's largest research universities, the collection of 15 universities, is that there's a greater demand by incoming undergraduate students who drive a lot of the budgeting for universities, so we have to just be practical for a minute. There's a greater demand from these students, either before they enter the university or while they are there, for interdisciplinary studies. So in some ways, that's actually hugely positive because they're interested in crossing traditional disciplinary boundaries. And this may or may not have structural impacts of universities that are now beginning to develop non-faculty structures, such as the College of Sustainability at Dalhousie would be one example, that isn't a faculty, but it runs programs. And it's managed by a group of deans. It's actually run out of 5 different faculties. And the fact that the students themselves are interested in interdisciplinary work feeds right into a lot of what we've been speaking about in teaching them across disciplines, taking English students and educating them along with computer science students, for instance, or with earth sciences students who work with GIS. There's a huge amount of possibility there. So while I share your angst, if I can refer to it as that. I don't know you well enough to know if you suffer from angst. But your words implied it. So, yes. I do actually see quite a lot of hope. I also see hope through, in terms of scholarship, because of Shirk's current evolution and revolution of its funding program structure, which is emphasizing the value of partnerships both partnerships across universities and partnerships with the public sector, with government departments where it's relevant and so on, and with the private sector. Now, while I know from watching some of my colleagues recently, I know the enormous effort of putting together a proposal for a large international partnership grant, these are also fairly significant amounts of money, and they help foster new thinking by the new generation of scholars and HQP, the training of high-quality personnel and so on. So I think there are things, while there is a dwindling pot overall, I think the different pots are being used in ways that will help foster new understanding.
Yes, I've been thinking about this from the perspective of the angst of the humanist as opposed to the person in engineering, science, or business, and particularly, again, from the student perspective. I always like to tell the story of the time I asked a class, why are you studying history? Why did you decide to become a history major? And one young man put up his hand and said, well, what he literally said was, math sucks. By which he meant, I think, I just feel that the world of both business and science and technology is closed to me because I don't feel I can do math. I could do history, I could do English. And so there's a kind of defensiveness about the humanities, which is not a positive thing for that person. Even if he goes on to become a history teacher, it would be better if he could actually learn to open himself to the world of math, as he calls it. And I think the digital humanities actually offers the possibility of that, that it does bring the humanities into touch with that other world.
Crowdsourcing came up, and that is a way of doing things for very little money.
Yes.
And I think that there's a more positive way to put that, which is that with crowdsourcing projects, and the famous one is the Australian newspaper project, it's actually a way of engaging people outside the university in actual research. And giving them a sense of pride and productivity and so forth, and also letting them into some of the things that we do, sharing it with them, saying you're part of this, and this is all that in fact you are actually helping us learn things about the world. And so actually I think we can think about crowdsourcing as both a way of trying to digitize things in a good, you know, do optical character recognition or whatever, cheaply, but also as a way of, in fact, raising the profile of the humanities, making people feel that the humanities are important. And I think if we remind people that the humanities are about things that people love, like movies and music and books and so forth, I think there's a case to be made that hasn't really been made properly. So, and I think maybe digital humanities are part of that case.
Yeah, and I would add, I think that those are good things to remind people, society, our students, ourselves. I think it's also good to remind ourselves that teaching can change, can evolve, and it seems to me that the major transformations in teaching, it's a shame when it's economic factors that are leading to them. You'd much rather have changes happening for pedagogical reasons, but they don't tend to happen spontaneously for pedagogical reasons, at least not on a scale that makes sense now. And so, you know, I would tend to say that I'm very aware and questioning of the of some of the changes that are being pushed down. On the other hand, I think that in most of the, you know, speaking maybe more from my perspective in digital humanities, there are things that could be taught differently. There are things that could be taught to massive classrooms, whether I'm there teaching it or whether they're getting it from other sources. There are also moments when students, humanities students, are encountering difficult programming concepts or techniques for the first time, that it's really like learning a language. And we know that language classes can't be big if they're going to be effective. There's a small percentage of the population that's self-disciplined enough to learn things on their own. But for the rest of us, we really need that interaction with
with an expert or with someone who's able to guide us through the material, make us practice, correct us in real time as we're doing it. And there's a component to digital humanities that is very much like that as well.
Are there other questions?
On the issue of teaching, I'm a neurosurgeon, and so we're undergoing a huge difference in our ability to train neurosurgeons, and that's because, you know, neurosurgical residents at one time could work 80 or 90 hours a week, and now through a number of ways, they're basically asked to work 48 hours a week. So, you know, we can extend their training from, let's say, 6 years to 7 years, mm-hmm. but there's a limit here. And so what we've begun to do is to go into a virtual reality world, mm-hmm. where before, you know, you do the operation on the human, and you learn in that way. But now, since we don't have the time that we used to have, we have a virtual reality operation. So we can have virtual reality bleeding, we can have virtual reality tumors, the brain is in three dimensions, it pulsates. It's an incredible way of moving forward with the teaching process. So one of the things that I've begun to think about is, and I've actually begun to talk to engineers about, why can't we do this with books? Why can't we have the same type of virtual reality that we have with brain pulsating, doing operations on brain, actually doing it with books? So that not only do you look in and you see the book in three dimensions, you turn the pages in three dimensions. If you want, like a hot tub, you can actually smell the book if you want, and you can do all the various things in that way. There isn't really a reason why that can't be done. And you can see the huge advantage you can have in such ways. For example, in our world of neurosurgery, you have a tough operation. You can have 8 different universities do the same operation and decide what is the best way of doing that operation in the virtual reality world. So if you have all the virtual reality system associated with libraries, you could do the similar things, have researchers throughout the world turning the same pages at the same time in this virtual reality world. So in one way, I think that's a way of moving forward. We have to do it. We have to do it because we can't train our people in other ways. But I don't see any reason why other people shouldn't be able to do this, because the technology is now available to do these things.
This reminds me of Fiona's mosquito.
Yes. Well, I was just going to say, I think that's a simulation in neurosurgery and other medical and health fields is a wonderful analogy, I think. A few years ago, I'm afraid I can't remember in which year, digital paper and digital ink was being experimented with in some ways, possibly more than it is now. And the digital ink seemed to work quite well, that as you turned a page, it would refresh with the text of page 32 or whatever not book it was. But the digital paper wasn't working out very well. Stefan, perhaps you know more about this than I do. And I haven't seen any recent articles on digital paper and digital ink in a codex format. Have you seen something about this?
No, it seems to have fallen off the plot. Yeah, tablets and yes. Readers have sort of yes. eclipsed the yes. digital
yes.
paper.
Yes. It's a great idea, though.
The thing that I would add to that is, and I'm not really totally up to date on the technology, but in terms of teaching old printing, which of course is one of the best ways to teach about old books and rare books, is to give students an opportunity to do printing. But there are technologies where you can use your mouse to pick up a piece of type and lay it down in a virtual composing stick,
yes.
and compose a virtual line of type and move it into a virtual form. And I think, you know, for the student who doesn't have the opportunity to work in a bibliographical press, which is what 99.999% of students, that is a technology that I'd like us to be exploring.
I think the simulations really provides exciting possibilities. I think, though, that in digitization, usually there's, in that translation of form, there's a normalization, there are choices that are made. And I think one of the important things to keep in mind from a humanities perspective is that we tend to value idiosyncratic experiences with things that may be peeled away, may be left aside in a simulation. You know, it's also that we're creating, it's partly about the individual experiences that can't be collectively taught. There aren't right practices necessarily. Mm-hmm. which is, you know, more about the humanities epistemology than anything.
If I could get in here, too, and maybe steer this in a slightly different way, that your question about neurosurgery or your experience of neurosurgery, some that there's a real ethical of not messing up on a real human, too, as you're learning. That's a real... Right. And that maybe the ethical analogy here has to do with, you know, mentioned a few times, the matter of cultural heritage, too. That, you know, I have colleagues who work on Tibetan archives, where it's vital that this enormous store of ancient knowledge be preserved, because the papers just turn into dust before your eyes. So the piece of cultural heritage preservation through digitization, then how do you work with it? But that the digital, the ethical piece of cultural heritage may be analogous to how do you learn to do brain surgery well through simulation. Other questions? I get carried away.
Well, actually, I mean, I'd just like to respond to that. I mean, the Ichiro also has a project called something like Musical Archivists Without Borders, and which in he went to a guy in Lebanon who's got thousands of old cassette type tapes of Arabic music from the 20th century, and so he actually went and showed him how to digitize those cassette tapes. In other words, gave him the technology and set up the database for him, and then allowed that guy to do his own cultural preservation. And so it's not a question of us doing it all, it's a question of providing the tools for other people and to do their own cultural preservation. And they can do it the way they want, but if we can at least give them the tools to do it. And that's a great promise of digitization, actually.
Would you join me then in thanking our four panelists? For what has been a very stimulating discussion, I think, and also very lively. And I think that speaks words to the intersections and interactions between the digital, the material, and the personal in all of this. So thank you all for your attention.